September 21st, 2010, the first day of the Harvest Festival in Korea, which celebrates kind of like the fall harvest and thanks the, I guess, the gods for the successful summer period. So on this festival, I called my parents for the result, and I said, you know, I was kind of saying happy Chuseok, and I asked them what was going on, and they said this. A record-breaking 200-millimeter torrential downpour happened within a couple of hours in Seoul. So these are kind of images up there in Seoul. And then nearby regions, which was the agricultural lands. And these are supposed to be all standing right up there, I believe, rice. So it was supposed to be all standing up, and now they're all kind of ruined. So my parents said, this is going to be pretty devastating in the next couple of weeks because the price of agricultural goods are going to skyrocket and inflation is going to happen. So 2 weeks later, I called back and I said, what has happened? And I said, there's been a mass race to the markets of hoarding of cabbages in particular, because the price of cabbages had risen from $4 to $14 a head within that 2 week span. And also because that was the beginning of the kimjang season, which is when all the family members get together and make the kimchi that would be consumed for the rest of the winter. So everybody felt threatened that they wouldn't be able to secure any cabbages or have kimchi for the rest of the winter months. Another really interesting thing about this was that people started stealing cabbages from these type of, well, this is a rice field, but cabbage farms to sell them on the market for that inflated price to make a profit. So the government stepped in to import cabbages from China and also tried to distribute them properly, but it remained a kimchi crisis for about a month and a half. So I thought, oh, this is perfect. Maybe I have something to kind of look into. And then it got better, of course, where the American media picked it up 3 weeks after the September 21st date, and they started reporting it as kind of a whimsical, lighthearted entertainment. And they described this kimchi crisis as this. So kimchi as ketchup, kimchi as Thanksgiving turkey, and a reporter at the LA Times kind of describing what this crisis meant to Koreans. They said, forcing Italians to forego pasta or taking all the tea from China. And I said, wow, now this is something I can look into, because why is kimchi still so foreign and exotic in America? And also I wanted to look at the position of kimchi in the American culinary landscape. So from 2008, and the reason why I mentioned 2008 earlier is because this was when the Korean government announced its mission to globalize Korean food by 2017. And one of its missions is to increase exports of domestic products, which includes kimchi and whatnot. So I know it'll be slightly boring, but I'm gonna read off my paper that I have because I get slightly muddled up when I try to go through my academic paper. So. Let's see. So this paper examines, the proportions are stuffy. Okay. So this paper examines the increased popularity and widespread acceptance of kimchi in the American cultural landscape since late 2008. It primarily focuses on the introduction of kimchi as a cosmopolitan, trendy, and healthful food item to a non-Korean consumer in America. I will compare and contrast three brands of kimchi: mother-in-law's, Mama O's premium kimchi, and Granny Cho's kimchi. All three brands were established between fall 2008 and spring 2009. Although these artisanal brands have varying degrees of production scale and distribution networks, young Korean Americans are behind these brands, marketing kimchi for American consumers who are looking for high quality, authentic, and healthful products. I term this type of kimchi makers kimchi mongers to differentiate them from other commercial producers of kimchi. I use the term monger in a positive way, to highlight the artisanal skill and knowledge necessary to for their occupation. By analyzing the kimchi mongers' business philosophy obtained through semi-structured interviews and examining their distribution channels and online recipes, I will demonstrate how kimchi makers are gastro-diplomats in the purest sense by actively constructing a non-Korean, mainly an upper-middle-class American demand for artisanal kimchi by trading on authenticity, exclusivity, and locality. So what is kimchi? Kimchi is widely known as a fermented cabbage dish, but the word actually means to pickle vegetables. Even though there are more than 200 types of kimchi that vary depending on growing seasons and regional flair, this was not always what kimchi was like. For example, the earliest mention of kimchi in historical texts is during the Three Kingdoms era. During this period, kimchi was simply pickled with salt to preserve vegetables during the winter months. And in Goryeo Dynasty, the types of kimchi expanded and began introducing ingredients such as garlic and green onions. Just to go back to the previous slide, the ones that we know today is red, really garlicky, very spicy, and it really has that strong punch, right? But before, it really didn't until the Joseon Dynasty. It started to look and taste more similar to the ones that we are used to today because of the introduction of the red chili pepper. So how does one make kimchi? So it starts with the brining phase where kimchi is, the napa cabbages are washed, then quartered and brined and seasoned with rock salt for about 5 hours at room temperature. And then the seasonings are prepared while the cabbages are brining. So garlic, ginger, Korean red pepper flakes, also shrimp, fermented shrimp paste. Next, radishes and scallions are chopped and diced in order to make the stuffing here, which combines the seasonings and also the, from the previous slide, and also the vegetables being cut. This is usually just called the stuffing. So once the stuffing is made, the cabbage is taken out of the brine, and then each layer of the cabbage is spread with that stuffing. And next, you put it in those huge pots, and you dig, you usually dig a hole in the ground, and you place those pots underneath and cover them, and that would last you for the entire winter. So maybe from October until March, and then you would start kind of making kimchi again. So, kimchi recipes are passed down from one generation of women to another. Most people have fierce pride in their mother's kimchi, holding it as the golden standard when judging other variations. Kimchi is intimately connected to the maker as she handcrafts batches, and it is thought that the hands impart that perfect taste. In fact, in describing flavors of kimchi, many talk about 손맛, literally translated as the taste of hands. Kimchi is also entwined with the Korean diet that is eaten at almost every meal. Data published by the Korean Rural Economic Institution reveal that the per capita consumption has been steadily increasing from 19.5 kilograms in 2005 to 22.3 kilograms in 2009. Kimchi is frequently associated with delineating and embodying Korean national identity. After the Korean government designated kimchi as a national dish during the 1988 Seoul Summer Olympics, both Koreans and non-Koreans have associated kimchi with Korea. Kimchi, with its strong taste and pungent smell, acts as a boundary marker to determine who is truly Korean. The belief that only real Koreans can genuinely appreciate kimchi's unique taste and smell is pervasive among Koreans. Laura Nelson postulates that kimchi has become a boundary marker for Koreans because the, quote, spicy garlic redolent bite is frequently presented as a metaphor for the direct, passionate behavior of Koreans, in contrast, for example, to the bland, minimalist, exquisite cuisine of the oppressive Japanese, end quote. The use of kimchi to distinguish us from others signifies the unique Korean character embodied in its consumption. Kimchi is especially compelling for Koreans in projecting national identity because it symbolizes energy and masculinity, and the consumption of spiciness implies successful combat and perseverance. The Korean government has continued its mission to establish kimchi as a national dish and has made significant progress in transforming the once stigmatized dish for its pungent smell into a global food that is appealing to non-Koreans. In July 2001, Korea established an international standard of kimchi through the official designation from the World Health Organization and the Food and Agricultural Organization's Codex Alimentarius Commission. Once kimchi was internationally recognized as Korean, the government proceeded to globalize it. For example, in 2004, the Korean government worked with Le Cordon Bleu Seoul, a branch of the legendary French culinary school, to create a cookbook that features Korean fusion dishes. Dishes such as camembert kimchi fritters and light kimchi-infused pastry cream millefeuille are featured in the book. Kimchi is not only traversing culinary territories, but also was launched into space. I don't know, it says Korean space food there. In April 2008, kimchi was thrown into orbit as the first Korean astronaut, Lee So-young, embarked on her space mission at the International Space Station. Back on Earth, the Korean government has been researching ways to systematize and regulate recipes, spice levels, and quality standards to help guide consumers and appeal to a wider audience. A gradient system is in the works to categorize the level of kimchi spiciness based on a 5-level scale measuring gochujang, which is the red pepper paste, hot taste units, or GHU, which is here. According to the Korea Agrofisheries Trade Corporation, in 2009, total Korean exports reached 28,505 tons, and increased to 29,672 tons in 2010. The total export revenue jumped from 89,386,000 to 98,360,000 US dollars in the same period. 85% of the total Korean kimchi exports are heading straight to Japan, 3% to Taiwan, 2% to the US, and 1.5% to Hong Kong, and 1% to Australia. And I'm not quite sure what the other signifies here, because it was taken from a government statistics report. These export statistics reveal that the Korean government is promoting local brands to a global audience. So now we turn to kimchi in America. Before the rise of American interest in kimchi, it was either imported directly from Korea or made locally for Korean communities. According to the most recent analysis of the U.S. kimchi market, conducted in 2007 by Korea Agrofisheries Trade Corporation, a total of 15,907 tons of kimchi worth 105,289,000 is consumed in America. 95% of the U.S. market is dominated by local brands that are either owned or produced by Korean supermarkets or restaurants, and the remaining 5% is imported directly from Korea. So last summer, I was doing a little bit more research on this, and I called the Korea Agrofisheries Trade Corporation, and I said, why is the most recent report in 2007, there's been so much more happening in the U.S. market? And they said, oh, it's not really our biggest target because our biggest markets are in Japan. So I guess the 2% market share that the US has is insignificant to them to actually do another analysis of what's happening in America. And there's a lot of happening in America. For example, there are three broad types of kimchi sold for household consumption in the US. The first is predominantly for the approximately 1.4 million Americans of Korean descent, and they buy local Korean restaurants, for example, Kumgangsan restaurant in New York City, or Korean grocery stores like the national chain H Mart, and those are the ones on the far upper corner there, or like the middle up there, and also the brand on the bottom. The second is geared toward the general public. So examples are like King's Kimchi or Sunjja's Kimchi. You may have seen these products in kind of the Stop and Shops and also larger Walmarts and whatnot. And then this one is Rejuvenate Food, which is more kind of targeting the health conscious clientele. The third and most recent development is the introduction of artisanal brands such as Mother-in-Law's and Mama O's. And this is actually taken from Sari Seeds, because back in, I believe last year, March, they conducted a survey or kind of a report on what the best kimchi is in America. And they decided that it was that one on top, which is made by a New York company. And even though it has MSG, they claimed that it was the best. And I actually just added this in, so it's not part of the graphic, just to make sure that I'm being clear with my sources. So, the small scale artisanal brands focus on niche markets like farmers markets or specialty food stores and online sales. Kimchi-infused or inspired dishes have been cropping up all over the country in high-end, fast food, and non-ethnic restaurants. In late 2008, Roy Choi founded Kogi, a food truck serving Korean-Mexican fare to the masses in Los Angeles. His signature dishes include short rib tacos with kimchi slaw and kimchi quesadillas. Kimchi also debuted on celebrity chefs' dishes with interesting twists. For example, Wiley Dufresne made a lobster dish with kimchi banana sauce. The role of the celebrity chef has been instrumental in presenting the idea of kimchi as a high-end product. John George and Marja von Gretchen's PBS TV show titled Kimchi Chronicles introduces kimchi recipes, and contestants of Bravo TV's Top Chef Season 9 have also won challenges that incorporated kimchi in their presentations. Since consuming and enjoying kimchi has long been a barrier to enter into Korean culture, non-Koreans eating kimchi is more significant than one might think. By eating a morsel of kimchi, a non-Korean can cross over to the other side that was only once reserved for ethnic Koreans, which may stir a sense of thrill, adventure, and novelty. This increased popularity of kimchi created a niche market for the Korean Americans to jump in as guests or diplomats to actively construct a non-Korean demand for upscale artisanal products infused with notions of authenticity, exclusivity, and locality. Shin Lu and Gary Fine demonstrate that Americans associate individuals consuming ethnic cuisines as, quote, cosmopolitan and tolerant. However, non-Korean consumers are looking for mediated spaces where they can try something new with a familiar setting. Lu and Fine discuss how ethnic foods need to strike a delicate balance between being perceived as simultaneously foreign and local. They assert that a sense of security must be established so that, quote, consumers can encounter the other while not straying too far from their own tastes, end quote. The introduction and acceptance of ethnic foods are based on exoticness and assimilation, where the global and the local are reimagined and redefined. Pierre Bourdieu's concept of cultural capital can be applied to explain the marketing strategies adopted by kimchi makers to appeal to non-Korean consumers who are looking for ways to become more cosmopolitan and tolerant. Bourdieu claimed that the acquisition of knowledge, skill, and experience can be converted into higher power and status. Kimchi makers are marketing their product as authentic, exclusive, and artisanal to convince their target consumers that they will be able to acquire higher social and cultural status through their products. So, mother-in-law's kimchi envisions its customers to be well-traveled, educated, and able to have access to good food. Mother-in-law's draws parallels of kimchi to wine and cheese and provides advice on wine pairings with kimchi on their website. In contrast, Mama O's kimchi appeals to locavores and hipsters in New York City to carry out a kimchi revolution through a grassroots approach. Granny Cho's kimchi primarily targets young professionals with high disposable income who are looking for vegan kimchi. Since these brands are sold in upscale food stores such as Whole Foods Market, Dean & DeLuca, and Murray's Cheese, one can hypothesize that the target clientele for these brands are affluent, cosmopolitan, and sophisticated who are willing to pay the price for a taste of genuine kimchi. Product price also contributes to marketing to a non-Korean clientele. The price of a 17-ounce packet of imported jjongganjip kimchi, a popular brand in Korea, is usually sold for $5.99 in Korean grocery stores in New York City. In contrast, the artisanal brands reach from $8.99 to $10 for 16-ounce jars. The elevated price is indicative of a business model based on marketing these brands as modern and handcrafted. To further the idea of exclusivity, these artisanal brands emphasize strong connections to family recipes derived from the entrepreneurs' mothers. All of the kimchi mongers echoed that the driving force behind launching their brands was the desire to share their mother's recipe with the masses. For example, Lauren Chung, she's the one on the far right, created mother-in-law's based on a 20-year-old recipe of her mother's successful Korean restaurant, Jangmokjip, in Garden Cove, California. She articulates that after 9 years of lugging jars of her mother's kimchi to meet her friend's cravings in New York City, she decided that she wanted to be in the business of sharing it with a wider community. Based on this premise, mother-in-law's kimchi consumers immediately become Lauren's friends, who crave her mother's kimchi because Lauren's mother is the ultimate bearer of that authentic taste. The connection between Korean women as authority on how to make the best kimchi is also strongly played out in Granny Cho's, a mother-daughter team. The brand explains that Oki was the talent behind its recognition as the 2009 winner of a Critter Kimchi contest. That is her on the right. Connie, her daughter, writes, quote, "Back in the day, awesome kimchi was hard to come by unless you A, lived in the motherland, or B, had access to a Korean grandmother," end quote. A photo of Oki, Connie, and Connie's daughter accompanies this introduction to their brand. The photo reinforces their strong family bond and focuses on the women's role as purveyors of and authorities of kimchi. The kimchi mongers convince their customers that they are giving them access to a product that is usually exclusively available to family members or ethnic Koreans. These artisanal brands reinforce the idea that only Koreans can make kimchi the correct way from traditional recipes passed down to Korean mothers. Although Kadeem Oh, the mastermind behind Mama O's, breaks the mold as a male kimchi monger, he maintains the authority paradigm as he crafts small batches of kimchi following his mother's recipe. He honors his mother by naming his brand after her and using a caricature of a plump, motherly figure on its label to convey a traditional Korean mother who is particular about how fresh, natural, and delicious her kimchi is. Kadeem also fell into the business, inadvertently only driven by the desire to make his mother's kimchi for himself. He mastered his mother's recipe and began giving out batches to his friends who urged him to sell it. By connecting his brand image closely to his mother, Mama O's reinforces the notion of authenticity and exclusivity because his kimchi is derived from the O's family recipe. The idea of authenticity and exclusivity promoted by these kimchi mongers can be further explained through Dean McCannell's notion of front and back spaces. McCannell asserts that due to the displacement felt by people through the process of modernity, they're continuously in search of genuine experiences that are imagined to be located in private back spaces. He contends that, quote, the front is the meeting place of hosts and guests for customers and service persons, and the back is the place where members of the home team retire between performances to relax and to prepare, end quote. The Korean-American kimchi mongers are commodifying homemade kimchi to inspire consumers with a desire to taste Korean culture. The kimchi that these kimchi mongers make is grounded in highly nostalgic ideas of mothers cooking for the family. These brands play up an ideal mother-child relationship that reinforces the idea that eating kimchi made by these producers transports the consumer into the back regions of the Korean families and further into Korean culture. Now, I wanted to just show a clip of this. I just wanted to kind of give you a visual. This is Lauren Chun and her mother, and they are kind of behind the mother-in-law's brand. And what I wanted to show you guys in the beginning was that those hand gestures of the daughter kind of patting her mother's hand and saying, oh no, it's okay, I'll take care of this in Korean, and the host saying, oh, you know, you have the ideal mother and daughter relationship. So they're really playing up that connection, that bond between the women to make their brand very successful. So. Authenticity and exclusivity are major factors that establish consuming artisanal kimchi as a form of cultural capital. The kimchi mongers' ability to play up locality is a crucial ingredient to their success. Distinctive local flavors and preferences are considered to make kimchi approachable to the non-Korean customer unfamiliar with its taste and use. Mother-in-laws and Granny Cho's kimchi offer recipes on their websites, which can be categorized as either traditional Korean or modern American adaptations. Some of the fusion dishes that mother-in-laws introduces are grilled cheese and kimchi sandwich, kimchi Bloody Mary, kimchi frittata, kimchi ceviche, and kimchi tacos. Granny Cho's offers kimchi stuffing and kimchi salsa as new ways to incorporate kimchi into the American diet. Although Kadeem O, after the owner of Mama O's, does not offer online recipes, he continues exploring ways to incorporate kimchi into the American diet through dishes like kimchi chili, kimchi salsa, and kimchi kraut, which he terms my perfect interracial babies. In July 2011, he organized Kimchi Palooza as a cooking and eating event called Cookout NYC. where he debuted kimchi ephemera like mango daikon radish popsicle. These fusion dishes are all examples of how the kimchi mongers are appropriating kimchi to fit into the specific locality in which it is being introduced. Introducing and teaching their clientele how to integrate kimchi into their diets in a safe, mediated space is a compelling way to make kimchi more accessible so that consumers can truly believe that they are part of the romanticized Korean family. The danger of foreignness is mediated by combining familiar items to make it palatable and safe. The kimchi mongers act as cultural guides by suggesting diverse ways to use kimchi without forcing the consumers to forego familiar ingredients and cooking methods. With little effort by the non-Korean consumer, the barrier to enter into the Korean culture is lifted by eating a batch of artisanal kimchi. Kimchi mongers capitalize on non-Korean consumers' desire to imagine themselves as cosmopolitan and open-minded food connoisseurs. They specifically cater to these sensibilities by employing sophisticated marketing, labeling, and storytelling strategies. As Bourdieu argues, consumption is, quote, a stage in a process of communication that is an act of deciphering, decoding, which presupposes practical or explicit mastery of a cipher or code, end quote. The non-Korean consumer depends on the kimchi mongers to feed them an understanding of the cultural nuances of kimchi because they lack the ability to expertly navigate Korean kimchi culture on their own. As they straddle both global and local fields, the kimchi mongers expertly navigate the two to produce a hybrid form of kimchi through localization. Although the Korean government's goal to increase exports of Korean produced kimchi and the kimchi mongers' vision to dominate American kimchi market and beyond may be disparate, both are in the pursuit of increasing the demand for Korean kimchi, a common difference of sorts. The slogan, think globally and act locally, captures the global kimchi phenomenon that is increasing the diversity of sunmat represented in the global kimchi business. So what lies ahead for kimchi in America? I would say hybrids and more commodification, because as we can see, these two are brands from Skim Kim. And this one I actually came across on in December when I was in Seoul, and Kim Jong-un had passed away that day, and I actually saw this and I thought, oh, this is slightly inappropriate timing, but it's really interesting whether or not it would sell. And I think they're very successful in Brooklyn. They're kind of a sister team that does this. And also they make kimchi butter, and they argue that it's excellent on everything. And I would see more of this type of fusion and also commodification, and also kind of the same type of storyline of trying to connect their ethnic heritage or their Korean heritage to their products to kind of sell it more. Also on the top over there is one of the dishes that Paul Chi, the winner of Top Chef Season 9, made for one of the challenges. It's supposed to be a healthier version of Korean galbi with the side is peach kimchi, which I thought was really interesting with cilantro. I'm not quite sure what the flavor profile would be, but I thought that was kind of an interesting twist. So I think we would see more kind of plays with that. So with that, thank you so much, and I'll take any questions if you have. Yes.
So the flood mm-hmm. was in what year?
In 2010.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you asked, did you try kimchi before a certain year? It was before. In other words, the point was before the Korean government decided to market it as a product.
So I marked 2008 as a turning point,
right,
because that's when it became really visible in the U.S.
Okay.
And I think a lot of that was because the government has been funding a lot of projects and restaurants and individuals to promote Korean food, and I think we see like the Kobe truck started in 2008 and has been blowing up since, and there's kind of variations of those type of food trucks are everywhere. I'm not quite sure if the Connecticut food trucks are picking up on that too, but there's multiple ones in New York and also in all over just a thinking.
I just had it, I worked in Manhattan, and my office was 2 blocks away from a little Korean town area, and a gentleman I worked with was Korean, so that was my introduction to it. But I do see it everywhere. I mean, you even see it in salad bars, and I don't know if it's the real thing, but it's...
Oh, I think it's going to move quite far from the real thing now and have more options.
I was wondering, I had two questions. One is, to what extent do you think you'll see other vegetables besides cabbage marketed as kimchi? And the second thing is the degree to which the taste has been all watered down through as they try and expand the market. Is it less stinky? Is it less spicy? As they adapt to American taste, has it changed from what you might get?
I think there's more more wiggle room with the ingredient of kimchi, just because in Korea you could get just varieties and varieties, like 200 varieties of it. And in the US now they're doing a lot of radishes, like daikon radish. And also I know a lot of the farmers markets have this, where the small vendors make it with like mustard greens even, or baby bok choy, or just anything. So I think with even the peach kimchi, I think that could be kind of variations of this. And then for your second question, for example, just kind of going back to the slide with the examples of kimchi. For example, King's kimchi, which you can find in most grocery stores around the country, and also Sunja's kimchi, I would say those are the watered down types. The ones that are mother-in-law's kimchi is actually very spicy, very, very spicy. And they use beef stock or even like bone marrow in their recipe, because they're supposed to, that type of kimchi is supposed to be eaten with a very big brothy soup of meat and bone marrow as well. So they're trying to complement that. So that's kind of a specific kimchi for that particular soup. But that is very stinky. I did a tasting of that in New Orleans when I was presenting this paper before, and the room got stinky really quickly. And then the other, the Korean market brands, I wouldn't say they're that watered down. They just taste slightly generic. And I can't really explain how they taste generic, but it doesn't taste like, it was because it was mass produced, so it wasn't very individual. But the small scale ones, they don't taste mass produced. Every batch is different because they make small batches.
The stickiness is really the, I mean, I grew up in an Eastern European household and cabbage was a staple for us. And it is a stinky vegetable. So the fermentation coupled with everything else is probably what makes it.
The garlic and the ginger, the shrimp paste.
Right. Stinky but good.
Yeah.
So of these brands, if any of us were to try it, what you would say the mother-in-law's?
I would say I probably shouldn't comment that much, but
a little
if I'm a little biased, mother-in-law's is very good. It's actually carried, I think it's most visible right now in the US, just because she was able to get into very high-end places first. So you can have her kimchi at Todd English's Food Hall in the Plaza. She's in all the gourmet stores in New York City, and also kind of branching out everywhere. Her kimchi is very pungent, really pungent, but it's very good. And also Mama O's is very good. I actually support his brand more because I find him to be a very interesting person and really fun. He's a DJ by night and kind of a kimchi monger by day. And the vegan kimchi, which is Granny Cho's, that one I tried, it was slightly too sugary. I think they actually add sugar. Whereas the other brands don't really add sugar, so it's more kind of the natural.
All those exports, most exports are to Japan. Why do you think that? Is it because the transportation costs are much lower, or is it just
the demand is really high? Actually, in 2001, when I showed you the Codex Alimentarius Commission standard, that was established because Japanese started claiming kimochi, which is the variation of kimchi, as their own national product. So the Korean government became very incensed, and they said, we can't have Japan take our kimchi when they've taken so much from us. So we started this campaign, and they were very successful in establishing as a Korean dish, and kind of regulated what needs to be in kimchi in order to for it to be called kimchi. So,
so there's now international standards?
Yes, yes. So just the spelling of it and ingredients and preparation.
So that suggests that the Japanese want to get away from their quote bland or diet.
I guess so. But actually, the kimchi in the ones that are exported, they are less spicy.
They do for Japanese.
Mm-hmm. And then the packaging is all different because it's written in Japanese. And when Japanese tourists come, they always buy bags and bags of kimchi, and they bring it back to Japan. And I know that for those specific clientele, they do have lesser spicy varieties.
So I have two questions, actually, and I'll stop.
No, it's okay.
So do they still bury it?
Oh, yeah, some people
so
do.
They,
mm-hmm.
Okay, but would you say even the locals, I mean, is that part of the fermentation process?
It's,
or it just
mm-hmm.
kind of bottle it up somehow?
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason why it's buried is because it maintains an optimal temperature throughout the winter so that it just stays there and it ferments perfectly. But nowadays, because most people don't have backyards, my grandparents had a backyard until I was about 20 or something. So every year we would go and we would do the process and make about 100 heads of cabbage and make kimchi for the winter months. And then we would bury it underneath the ground in her backyard. But nowadays, because everybody's now living in apartments, they have the thing called kimchi fridge, which is specifically made for kimchi. Only kimchi can go in there. So it helps with the containing the smell, it helps maintain that perfect temperature, and it's convenient. So almost every single apartment has that now, or it's built in, or most people have it.
And how is it a long process, you know, I'm sorry, is it long, is it like a long, how long does it have to ferment?
You can actually enjoy kimchi from the start. So you can eat it raw. You can eat it when it's about a year old. Or even some people say, 3 years fermentation is the best. It's that's when the ripe, But you wouldn't really eat it raw. You would put it in soups or stews or braises or something else to kind of take out that intensity. And some dishes require that type of depth of flavor. But you could eat it raw, just kind of like a salad, which is delicious. Or you can kind of, and usually people say about 2 weeks, and then like a full month.
So how does a kimchi container work in the refrigerator? How do they keep the smell?
I think the way that the air circulates, they try to take it away. I'm actually not very versed in how the kimchi fridge works in general. I just know that it maintains an optimal temperature and it circulates the air so that or maybe there's some type of chemical in there that absorbs. I'm not quite sure, but there's a small filter thing, so maybe that's the way. But I should look into that. That's a very good question.
Is the study of kimchi what you do full time, or how do you get into this? And how much?
This is actually not full time. I'm actually really interested in the Korean government's policy to globalize Korean food.
Uh-huh.
So it started in 2008, and they are targeting until 2017. This is a really interesting case because it coincides perfectly with the current president's term, which ends later this year. And his motive was to increase agricultural exports to about, now I'm blanking on the figure, but it was quite substantial. I would say maybe like $50 billion or something. No, that doesn't, $12 billion by 2012, which is the end of his term. So it'll be interesting to see what happens after 2012 when there's a new administration, because every single administration tries to do something that's global and international. So this was his tax. But we'll see what happens. So I'm going to keep on tracking it. And actually, I was asked to do this paper on Korean-American kind of producers. And I stumbled upon these three producers, and they were so willing to talk to me because they're so small. And they really kind of wanted to use me as a platform. And I guess I was using them as kind of a research material. So that's great.
How about North Korea? Do they also...
Actually, North Korea, they do promote their own culinary national dishes by, so they have government-run and operated restaurants in China. There's many in China. There's one in Cambodia, Vietnam, and other places. And I've actually been to one in China, and they serve North Korean dishes, and then there are beautiful women who are servers in the traditional Korean dresses who come and sing and serve you food and all this stuff. And I've heard that all of the money that's made in these restaurants go straight back to the administration. And there's just rigorous process of selecting who could be working at these restaurants and what happens. But the food is very good. And it's very different from South Korean cuisine. And South Korean cuisine has evolved so much in the past 50 years, whereas North Korean food has kind of stuck where it's been. So it's more true, like authentic than, I would say, where South Korean food has gone.
Probably putting the question the way I'm going to put it tells you what I think about it, but do you think that there's something about this commodification culture that should be not celebrated but deplored?
Hmm. I would say I'm actually more against what the Korean government's doing, just because it's trying to really homogenize a lot of stuff. And I would say, in terms of, because the Korean government's not really giving room for local producers, they're not recognizing these three kimchi mongers that I covered in this paper, just because they don't see them relevant to increasing their export figures, which I think is a real pity, because the Korean government doesn't really understand what Americans like and don't like, whereas these Korean Americans really know the market. They understand what sells and what doesn't sell. And I think the first step is really important to just get into people's consciousness or their culinary choices or whatnot, and then teach them about Korean culture rather than the Korean government just trying to barge in and say, this is Korean culture, where there's lots of history and lots of things to learn about before you actually eat. And nobody wants to sit through a history class or biology class before you eat something. So I think their approaches are slightly different. And I would say maybe for the Korean American producers, because they are targeting the upper middle class American, I would say maybe the negative there would be just not being able to give access to more people, where if like a 15 jar of kimchi is about $10, that's pretty expensive for someone else to, or someone who can't necessarily afford something like that to keep it.
Well, if it was $14 for a half cabbage at one point, that's...
But that was in Korea, so
right.
Yeah.
Let me answer that. My wife was in Korea years ago when they buried it, and told me the story, so, but I don't understand her. What's kind of the logistics? So you're Korean, in charge of family and stuff, food. How often do you go out and pick it out of the ground, and what's covering it? Mm-hmm. What's the day-to-day thing of getting this kimchi in the house?
It's actually really easy, because I've seen my grandmother do it multiple times. She just takes kind of a bucket, like a bowl or something, treads to the
in an urn, right?
Yes. Right. It's a deep pot, and she just uses her hands, takes it out. Over. Okay, so the pot, the tops of the pot are covered with straw, like a woven straw covering. So she takes that off, and then takes the pot covering off, and then on top of it, there's cabbage leaves that weren't part of the kimchi. To just cover it, to make sure that they are submerged continuously. And then she just peels that back and takes a couple of heads out, and then places everything back in and kind of carries it back.
She does it once a day.
Once a day, or if she takes more out than she could do, like maybe twice a week or something. Because once she chops it and prepares it or uses in other dishes, she could just put it in the refrigerator. So it's not that much of a hassle. It's just you need the space in order to bury it, and most people don't have that.
It was really just a method of preservation, mm-hmm. way back before
mm-hmm.
electricity and
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.